Disc 9.
Chapter 36. Vienna. Oded had made the drive a dozen times, but never like this. Never with the siren screaming in the dash, and never with Erich Radek's eyes in the rear-view mirror staring back into his own. Their flight from the city centre had gone better than expected. The evening traffic had been persistent, but never so heavy that it didn't part for his siren and flashing light. Twice Radek rebelled. Each uprising was ruthlessly put down by Navot and Zalman. They were racing north now on the E-461. The Vienna traffic was gone, the rain was falling steadily and freezing at the edges of the windshield. A sign flashed past, Czech Republic, 42 kilometers. Navot took a long look over his shoulder, then in Hebrew, instructed Oded to kill the siren and the lights.
"Where are we going?" Radek asked. His breathing labored. "Where are you taking me? Where?"
Navot said nothing, just as Gabriel had instructed.
"Let him ask questions till he's blue in the face," Gabriel had said. "Just don't give him the satisfaction of an answer. Let the uncertainty prey on his mind. That's what he would do if the roles were reversed."
So Navot watched the villages flashing past his window. Mistelbach, Wilfersdorf, Erdberg, and thought of only one thing, the bodyguard he had left unconscious in the entranceway of Radek's house on the Sturbergasse. Poisdorf appeared before them. Oded sped through the village, then turned into a two-lane road, and followed it eastward through snow-covered pine.
"Where are we going? Where are you taking me?"
Navot could endure his questions in silence no longer.
"We're going home," he snapped, "and you're coming with us."
Radek managed a glacial smile.
"You made only one mistake tonight, Herr Langer. You should have killed my bodyguard when you had the chance."
Klaus Halder opened one eye, then the other. The darkness was absolute. He lay very still for a moment, trying to determine the position of his body. He had fallen forward with his arms at his sides, and his right cheek was pressed against cold marble. When he tried to lift his head, a bolt of thunderous pain shot down his neck. He remembered it now, the instant it had happened. He'd been reaching for his gun when he'd been clubbed twice from behind. It was the lawyer from Zurich, Oskar Langer. Obviously Langer was no mere lawyer. He'd been in on it, just as Halder had feared from the beginning. He pushed himself onto his knees and sat back against the wall. He closed his eyes and waited until the room stopped spinning, then rubbed the back of his head. It was swollen the size of an apple. He raised his left wrist and squinted at the luminous dial of his wristwatch. 5:57. When had it happened? A few minutes after 5. 5:10 at the latest. Unless they'd had a helicopter waiting on the Stephansplatz, chances were they were still in Austria. He patted the right front pocket of his sport jacket and found that his cell phone was still there. He fished it out and dialed. Two rings. A familiar voice.
"This is Cruz."
30 seconds later, Manfred Cruz slammed down the phone and considered his options. The most obvious response would be to sound the alarm klaxons, alert every police unit in the country that the old man had been seized by Israeli agents, close the borders, and shut down the airport. Obvious, yes, but very dangerous. A move like that would raise many uncomfortable questions. Why was Herr Vogel kidnapped? Who is he really? Peter Metzler's candidacy would be swept away, and so, too, would Cruz's career. Even in Austria, such affairs had a way of taking on a life of their own, and Cruz had seen enough of them to know that the inquiry would not end at Vogel's doorstep. The Israelis had known he would be hamstrung, and they had chosen their moment well. Cruz had to think of some subtle way to intervene, some way to impede the Israelis without destroying everything in the process. He picked up the telephone and dialed.
"This is Cruz. The Americans have informed us that they believe an Al-Qaeda team may be transiting the country by automobile this evening. They suspect the Al-Qaeda members might be traveling with European sympathizers in order to better blend into their surroundings. As of this moment, I'm activating the terrorism alert network. Raise security at the borders, airports, and train stations to Category 2 status."
He rang off and gazed out the window. He had thrown the old man a lifeline. He wondered whether he would be in any condition to grab it. Cruz knew that if he succeeded, he would soon be confronted with yet another problem. What to do with the Israeli snatch team? He reached into the breast pocket of his suit jacket and removed a slip of paper. If I dial this number, who's going to answer? Violence. Manfred Cruz reached for his telephone. The clockmaker, since his return to Vienna, had scarcely found cause to leave the sanctuary of his little shop in the Stephansdom quarter. His frequent travels had left him with a large backlog of pieces requiring his attention, including a Vienna Biedermeier regulator clock, built by the renowned Vienna clockmaker Ignaz Marenzeller in 1840. The mahogany case was in pristine condition, though the one-piece silver dial had required many hours of restoration. The original handmade Biedermeier movement, with its 75-day runner, lay in several carefully arranged pieces on the surface of his work table. The telephone rang. He lowered the volume on his portable CD player, and Bach's Brandenburg Concerto No. 4 in G faded to a whisper. A prosaic choice, Bach, but then the clockmaker found the precision of Bach a perfect accompaniment to the task of dismantling and rebuilding the movement of an antique timepiece. He reached out for the telephone with his left hand. A shockwave of pain shot down the length of his arm, a reminder of his exploits in Rome and Argentina. He brought the receiver to his right ear and cradled it against his shoulder. Yes, he said inattentively. His hands were already at work again. I was given your number by a mutual friend. I see, the clockmaker said non-committally. How can I help you? It's not me who requires help. It's our friend. The clockmaker laid down his tools. Our friend? He asked. You did some work for him in Rome and Argentina. I assume you know the man I am referring to. The clockmaker did indeed. So the old man had misled him and twice put him in compromising situations in the field. Now he had committed the mortal operational sin of giving his name to a stranger. Obviously he was in trouble. The clockmaker suspected it had something to do with the Israelis. He decided that now would be an excellent moment to sever their relationship. I'm sorry, he said, but I believe you have me confused with someone else. The man at the other end of the line tried to object. The clockmaker hung up the phone and turned up the volume on his CD player until the sound of Bach filled his workshop. In the Munich safe flat, Carter hung up the telephone and looked at Shamron, who was still standing before the map, as if imagining Radek's progress northward toward the Czech border. That was from our Vienna station. They're monitoring the Austrian communications net. It seems Manfred Cruz has taken their terror alert readiness to Category 2. Category 2? What does that mean? It means you're likely to have a bit of trouble at the border. The turnout lay in a hollow at the edge of a frozen stream bed. There were two vehicles, an Opel sedan and a Volkswagen van. Chiara sat behind the wheel of the Volkswagen, headlights doused, engine silent, the comforting weight of a Beretta across her lap. There was no other sign of life, no lights from the village, no grumble of traffic along the highway, only the rattle of sleet on the roof of the van and the whistle of the wind through the spires of the fir trees. She glanced over her shoulder and peered into the rear compartment of the Volkswagen. It had been prepared for Radek's arrival. The rear fold-out bed was deployed. Beneath the bed was the specially constructed compartment where he would be hidden for the border crossing. He would be comfortable there, more comfortable than he deserved. She looked out the windshield. Not much to see, the narrow road rising into the gloom toward a crest in the distance. Then suddenly there was light, a clean white glow that lit the horizon and turned the trees to black minarets. For a few seconds it was possible to see the sleet, swirling like a cloud of insects on the wind-swept air. Then the headlamps appeared. The car breasted the hill, and the lights bore into her, throwing the shadow of the trees one way, then another. Chiara wrapped her hand around the Beretta and slipped her forefinger inside the trigger guard. The car skidded to a stop next to the van. She peered into the back seat and saw the murderer, seated between Navot and Zalman, rigid as a commissar waiting for the blood purge. She crawled into the rear compartment and made one final check.
"Take off your overcoat," Navot commanded. "Why?"
"Because I told you to.
I have a right to know why."
"You have no rights. Just do as I say."
Radek sat motionless. Zalman pulled at the lapel of his coat, but the old man folded his arms tightly across his chest. Navot sighed heavily. If the old bastard wanted one final wrestling match, he was going to get it. Navot pried open his arms while Zalman pulled off the right sleeve, then the left. The herringbone jacket came next. Then Zalman tore open his shirt sleeve and exposed the sagging bare skin of his arm. Navot produced a syringe, loaded with the sedative.
"This is for your own good," Navot said. "It's mild and very short in duration. It will make your journey much more bearable. No claustrophobia."
"I've never been claustrophobic. I don't care."
Navot plunged the needle into Radek's arm and depressed the plunger. After a few seconds, Radek's body relaxed. Then his head fell to one side and his jaw went slack. Navot opened the door and climbed out. He took hold of Radek's limp body beneath the armpits and dragged him out of the car. Zalman picked him up by the legs, and together they carried him, like war dead, to the side of the Volkswagen. Kiara was crouched inside, holding an oxygen bottle and a clear plastic mask. Navot and Zalman laid Radek on the floor of the Volkswagen. Then Kiara placed the mask over his nose and mouth. The plastic fogged immediately, indicating that Radek was breathing well. She checked his pulse, steady and strong. They maneuvered him into the compartment and closed the lid. Kiara climbed behind the wheel and started the engine. Oded slid the side door shut and wrapped his palm against the glass. Kiara slipped the Volkswagen into gear and headed back toward the highway. The others climbed into the Opel and followed after her. 5 minutes later, the lights of the border appeared like beacons on the horizon. As Kiara drew nearer, she could see a short line of traffic, about 6 vehicles in length, waiting to make the crossing. There were 2 border policemen in evidence. They had their flashlights out and were checking passports and looking through windows. She glanced over her shoulder. The doors over the compartment remained closed. Radek was silent. The car in front of her passed inspection and was released to the Czech side. The border policeman waved her forward. She lowered her window and managed a smile. "Passport, please." She handed it over. The second officer had maneuvered his way around to the passenger side of the van, and she could see the beam of his flashlight flickering. "Is something wrong?" The border policeman kept his eyes down on her photograph and said nothing.
"When did you enter Austria?"
"Earlier today."
"Where?"
"From Italy, at Tarvisio."
He spent a moment comparing her face to the photo in the passport. Then he pulled open the front door and motioned for her to get out of the van. Uzi Navot watched the scene from his vantage point in the front passenger seat of the Opel. He looked at Oded and swore softly under his breath. Then he dialed the Munich safe flat on his cell phone. Shamron answered on the first ring.
"We've got a problem," Navot said.
He ordered her to stand in front of the van and shone a light in her face. Through the glare, she could see the second border policeman pulling open the side door of the Volkswagen. She forced herself to look at her interrogator. She tried not to think of the Beretta pressing against her spine, or of Gabriel waiting on the other side of the border in Mikulov, or Navot, Oded, and Zalman watching helplessly from the Opel.
"Where are you traveling to this evening?"
"Prague," she said.
"Why are you going to Prague?"
She shot him a look. "None of your business." Then she said,
"I'm going to see my boyfriend."
"Boyfriend," he repeated. "What does your boyfriend do in Prague?"
"He teaches Italian,"
Gabriel had said. She answered the question.
"Where does he teach?"
"At the Prague Institute of Language Studies," Gabriel had said.
Again, she answered as Gabriel had instructed.
"And how long has he been a teacher at the Prague Institute of Language Studies?"
3 years.
"And do you see him often?"
"Once a month, sometimes twice."
The second officer had climbed inside the van. An image of Radek flashed through her mind, eyes closed, oxygen mask over his face.
Don't wake, she thought. Don't stir, don't make a sound, do the decent thing for once in your wretched life.
And when did you enter Austria?
I've told you that already.
Tell me again, please.
Earlier today.
What time?
I don't remember the time. Was it the morning? Was it the afternoon?
Afternoon.
Early afternoon? Late afternoon?
Early.
So it was still light.
She hesitated. He pressed her.
Yes, it was still light.
She nodded. From inside the van came the sound of cabinet doors being opened. She forced herself to look directly into the eyes of her questioner. His face, obscured by the harsh flashlight, began to take on the appearance of Erich Radek, not the pathetic version of Radek that lay unconscious in the back of the van, but the Radek who pulled a child named Irena Frankel from the ranks of the Birkenau Death March in 1945 and led her into a Polish forest for one final moment of torment.
Say the words, Jew. You were transferred to the East. You had plenty of food and proper medical care. The gas chambers and the crematoria are Bolshevik Jewish lies.
I can be as strong as you, Irena, she thought. I can get through this for you.
Did you stop anywhere in Austria?
No.
You didn't take the opportunity to visit Vienna?
I've been to Vienna, she said. I don't like it.
He spent a moment examining her face.
You are Italian, yes?
You have my passport in your hand.
I'm not referring to your passport. I'm talking about your ethnicity, your blood. Are you of Italian descent, or are you an immigrant from, say, the Middle East or North Africa?
I'm Italian, she assured him.
The second officer climbed out of the Volkswagen and shook his head. Her interrogator handed over the passport.
I am sorry for the delay, he said. Have a pleasant journey.
Chiara climbed behind the wheel of the Volkswagen, slipped the van into gear, and eased over the border. The tears came, tears of relief, tears of anger. At first, she tried to stop them, but it was no use. The road blurred, the taillights turned to red streamers, and still they came.
For you, Irena, she said aloud, I did it for you.
The Mikhailov train station lies below the old town, where the hillside meets the plain. There is a single platform that endures a near-constant assault of wind pouring down out of the Carpathian Mountains, and a melancholy gravel car park that tends to pond over when it rains. Near the ticket office is a graffiti-scarred bus shelter, and it was there, pressed against the leeward side, where Gabriel waited, hands plunged into the pockets of his oilskin jacket. He looked up as the van turned into the car park and crunched over the gravel. He waited until it came to a stop before stepping from the bus shelter into the rain. Chiara reached across and opened the door to him. When the overhead light came on, he could see her face was wet.
Are you all right?
I'm fine.
Do you want me to drive?
No, I can do it.
Are you sure?
Just get in, Gabriel. I can't stand being alone with him.
He climbed in and closed the door. Chiara turned around and headed back to the highway. A moment later, they were racing north, into the Carpathians. It took a half hour to reach Brno, another hour to get to Ostrava. Twice Gabriel opened the doors of the compartment to check on Radek. It was nearly 8 o'clock when they reached the Polish border. No security checks this time, no line of traffic, just a hand poking from the brick bunker waving them across the frontier. Gabriel crawled to the back of the van and pulled Radek from the compartment. Then he opened a storage drawer and removed a syringe. This time it was filled with a mild dosing of stimulant, just enough to raise him gently back to the surface of consciousness. Gabriel inserted the needle into Radek's arm, injected the drug, then removed the needle and swabbed the wound with alcohol. Radek's eyes opened slowly. He surveyed his surroundings for a moment before settling on Gabriel's face.
Allons, he murmured through the oxygen mask.
Gabriel nodded slowly.
Where are you taking me?
Gabriel said nothing.
Am I going to die?
He asked, but before Gabriel could answer, he slipped below the surface once more.
Chapter 37. Eastern Poland. The barrier between consciousness and coma was like a stage curtain, through which he could pass at will. How many times he slipped through this curtain he did not know. Time, like his old life, was lost to him. His beautiful house in Vienna seemed another man's house, in another man's city. Something had happened when he'd shouted out his real name at the Israelis. Ludwig Vogel was a stranger to him now, an acquaintance whom he had not seen in many years. He was Radek again. Unfortunately, time had not been kind to him. The towering, beautiful man in black was now imprisoned in a weak, failing body. The Jew had placed him on the fold-out bed. His hands and ankles were bound by thick silver packing tape, and he was belted into place like a mental patient. His wrists served as the portal between his two worlds. He had only to twist them at a certain angle, so that the tape dug painfully into his skin, and he would pass through the curtain from a dreamscape to the realm of the real. Dreams? Is it proper to call such visions dreams? No, they were too accurate, too telling. They were memories over which he had no control, only the power to interrupt them for a few moments by hurting himself with the Jew's packing tape. His face was near the window, and the glass was unobstructed. He was able, when he was awake, to see the endless black countryside and the dreary, darkened villages. He was also able to read the road signs. He did not need the signs to know where he was. Once, in another lifetime, he had ruled the night in this land. He remembered this road, Dachnau, Zukov, Narol. He knew the name of the next village, even before it slid past his window. Belzec. He closed his eyes. Why now? After so many years. After the war, no one had been terribly interested in a mere SD officer who had served in the Ukraine. No one but the Russians, of course. And by the time his name surfaced in connection with the final solution, General Galen had arranged for his escape and disappearance. His old life was safely behind him. He had been forgiven by God and his church, and even by his enemies, who had greedily availed themselves of his services when they too felt threatened by Jewish Bolshevism. The governments soon lost interest in prosecuting the so-called war criminals, and the amateurs like Wiesenthal focused on the big fish like Eichmann and Mengele, unwittingly helping smaller fish like himself find sanctuary in sheltered waters. There had been one serious scare. In the mid-70s, an American journalist, a Jew, of course, had come to Vienna and asked too many questions. On the road leading south from Salzburg, he had plunged into a ravine, and the threat was eliminated. He had acted without hesitation then. Perhaps he should have hurled Max Klein into a ravine at the first sign of trouble. He'd noticed him that day at the Café Central, as well as the days that followed. His instincts had told him that Klein was trouble. He'd hesitated. Then Klein had taken his story to the Jew Levant, and it was too late. He passed through the curtain again. He was in Berlin, sitting in the office of Gruppenführer Heinrich Müller, chief of the Gestapo. Müller is scraping a bit of lunch from his teeth, and waving a letter he'd just received from Luther in the Foreign Office. It is 1942.
It seems that rumors of our activities in the East have started to reach the ears of our enemies. We've also got a problem with one of the sites in the Wartegau region, complaints about contamination of some kind.
If I may ask the obvious question, Herr Gruppenführer, what difference does it make if rumors reach the West? Who would believe that such a thing was truly possible?
Rumors are one thing, Erich. Evidence is quite another.
Who's going to discover evidence? Some half-witted Polish serf? A slant-eyed Ukrainian ditch-digger?
Maybe the Ivans.
The Russians? How would they ever find?
Müller held up a bricklayer's hand, discussion over. And then he understood. The Führer's Russian adventure was not going according to plan. Victory in the East was no longer assured. Müller leaned forward at the waist.
I'm sending you to hell, Erich. I'm going to stick that Nordic face of yours so deep in the shit you'll never see daylight again.
How can I ever thank you, Herr Gruppenführer?
Clean up the mess, all of it,
everywhere. It's your job to make sure it remains only a rumor. And when the operation is done, I want you to be the only man standing.
He awakened. Müller's face withdrew into the Polish night.
Strange, isn't it? His real contribution to the final solution was not killing, but concealment and security. And yet he was in trouble now, 60 years on, because of a foolish game he'd played one drunken Sunday at Auschwitz. Axion 1005? Yes, it had been his show, but no Jewish survivor would ever testify to his presence at the edge of a killing pit, because there were no survivors. He'd run a tight operation. Eichmann and Himmler would have been advised to do the same. They'd been fools to allow so many to survive. A memory rose, January 1945. A chain of ragged Jews straggling along a road, very much like this one. The road from Birkenau. Thousands of Jews, each with a story to tell, each a witness. He'd argued for liquidation of the entire camp population before evacuation. No, he'd been told. Slave labor was urgently needed inside the Reich. Labor? Most of the Jews he'd seen leaving Birkenau could barely walk, let alone wield a pickaxe or a shovel. They weren't fit for labor, only slaughter, and he'd killed quite a few himself. Why in God's name did they order him to clean out the pits, and then allow thousands of witnesses to walk out of a place like Birkenau? He forced open his eyes and stared out the window. They were driving along the banks of a river near the Ukrainian border. He knew this river, a river of ashes, a river of bone. He wondered how many hundreds of thousands were down there, silt on the bed of the River Bug. A shuttered village, Urusk. He thought of Peter. He had warned this would happen. "If I ever become a serious threat to win the chancellery," Peter had said, "someone will try to expose us." He had known Peter was right, but he had also believed he could deal with any threat. He had been mistaken, and now his son faced an unimaginable electoral humiliation, all because of him. It was as if the Jews had led Peter to the edge of a killing pit and pointed a gun at his head. He wondered whether he possessed the power to prevent them from pulling the trigger, whether he could broker one more deal, engineer one final escape. "And this Jew, who stares at me now with those unforgiving green eyes? What does he expect me to do? Apologize? Break down and weep and spew sentimentalities? What this Jew does not understand is that I feel no guilt for what was done. I was compelled by the hand of God and the teachings of my church. Did the priests not tell us the Jews were the murderers of God? Did the Holy Father and his cardinals not remain silent when they knew full well what we were doing in the East? Does this Jew expect me now to suddenly recant and say it was all a terrible mistake? And why does he look at me like that?" They were familiar, those eyes. He'd seen them somewhere before. Maybe it was just the drugs they'd given him. He couldn't be certain of anything. He wasn't sure he was even alive. Perhaps he was already dead. Perhaps it was perhaps he was in hell. Another hamlet, Wola Uruska. He knew the next village, Sobibor. He closed his eyes. The velvet of the curtain enveloped him. It is the spring of 1942. He is driving out of Kiev on the Zhytomyr Road with the commander of an Einsatzgruppen unit at his side. They are on their way to inspect a ravine that's become something of a security problem, a place that Ukrainians call Babi Yar. By the time they arrive, the sun is kissing the horizon and it is nearly dusk. Still, there is just enough light to see the strange phenomenon taking place at the bottom of the ravine. The earth seems to be in the grips of an epileptic fit. The soil is convulsing, gas is shooting into the air, along with geysers of putrid liquid. The stench! Jesus, the stench! He can smell it now.
When did it start?
Not long after winter entered. The ground thawed, then the bodies thawed. They decomposed very rapidly.
How many are down there?
33,000 Jews, a few gypsies and Soviet prisoners for good measure.
Put a cordon around the entire ravine.
We'll get to this one as soon as we can. But at the moment, other sites have priority.
What other sights?
Places you've never heard of. Birkenau, Belzec, Sobibor, Treblinka. Our work is done here. At the others, they're expecting imminent new arrivals.
What are you going to do with this place?
We'll open the pits and burn the bodies, then we'll crush the bones and scatter the fragments in the forests and the rivers.
Burn 30,000 corpses?
We tried it during the killing operations. We used flamethrowers, for God's sake. Mass open-air cremations do not work.
That's because you never constructed a proper pyre.
At Chelno, I proved it can be done.
Trust me, Kurt, one day this place called Babi Yar will only be a rumor, just like the Jews who used to live here.
He twisted his wrists. This time the pain was not enough to wake him. The curtain refused to part. He remained locked in a prison of memories, wading across a river of ashes. They plunged on through the night. Time was a memory. The tape had cut off his circulation. He could no longer feel his hands and feet. He was feverishly hot one minute and shivering with cold the next. He had the impression of stopping once. He had smelt gasoline. Were they filling the tank? Or was it just the memory of fuel-soaked railroad ties? The effects of the drug finally wore off. He was awake now, alert and cognizant, and quite certain he was not dead. Something in the determined posture of the Jew told him they were nearing the end of their journey. They passed through Siedlce. Then, at Sokolov Podlaski, they turned onto a smaller country road. Dibov came next, then Kosovlatsky. They turned off the main road onto a dirt track. The van shuddered. Thump, 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 thump. The old rail line, he thought. It was still here, of course. They followed the track into a stand of dense fir and birch trees, and came to a stop a moment later in a small, paved car park. A second car entered the clearing with its headlights doused. Three men climbed out and approached the van. He recognized them. They were the ones who had taken him from Vienna. The Jew stood over him and carefully cut away the packing tape and loosened the leather straps.
"Come," he said pleasantly. "Let's take a walk."
Chapter 38. Treblinka, Poland. They followed a footpath into the trees. It had begun to snow. The flakes fell softly through the still air and settled on their shoulders like the cinders of a distant bonfire. Gabriel held Radek by the elbow. His steps were unsteady at first, but soon the blood began flowing to his feet again, and he insisted on walking without Gabriel's support. His labored breath froze on the air. It smelled sour and fearful. They moved deeper into the forest. The pathway was sandy and covered by a fine bed of pine needles. Oded was several paces ahead, barely visible through the snowfall. Zalman and Navot walked in formation behind them. Kiara had remained behind in the clearing, standing watch over the vehicles. They paused. A break in the trees, approximately 5 yards wide, stretched into the gloom. Gabriel illuminated it with the beam of a flashlight. Down the center of the lane, at equidistant intervals, stood several large upright stones. The stones marked the old fence line. They had reached the perimeter of the camp. Gabriel switched off the flashlight and pulled Radek by the elbow. Radek tried to resist, then stumbled forward.
"Just do as I say, Radek, and everything will be fine. Don't try to run, because there's no way to escape. Don't bother calling for help. No one will hear your cries."
"Does it give you pleasure to see me afraid?"
"It sickens me, actually. I don't like touching you. I don't like the sound of your voice."
"So why are we here?"
"I just want you to see some things."
"There's nothing to see here, Alon. Just a Polish memorial."
"Precisely." Gabriel jerked at his elbow. "Come on, Radek. Faster. You have to walk faster. We haven't got much time. It will be morning soon."
A moment later they stopped again before a trackless rail line, the old spur that had carried the transports from Treblinka station into the camp itself. The ties were recreated in stone and frosted over by new snow. They followed the tracks into the camp and stopped at the place where the platform had been. It, too, was represented in stone.
Do you remember it, Radek?
He stood silently, his jaw slack, his breathing ragged.
Come on, Radek. We know who you are. We know what you did. You're not going to escape this time. There's no use playing games or trying to deny any of it. There isn't time. Not if you want to save your son.
Radek's head swiveled slowly around. His mouth became a tight line and his gaze very hard.
You would harm my son?
Actually, you would do it for us. All we would have to do is tell the world who his father is, and it would destroy him. That's why you planted that bomb in Eli Levon's office, to protect Peter. No one could touch you. Not in a place like Austria. The window had closed for you a long time ago. You were safe. The only person who could pay a price for your crimes is your son. That's why you tried to kill Eli Levon. That's why you murdered Max Klein.
He turned away from Gabriel and peered into the darkness. What is it that you want? What do you want to know?
Tell me about it, Radek. I've read about it. I can see the memorial. But I can't picture how it could really work. How was it possible to turn a trainload of people into smoke in only 45 minutes? 45 minutes, door to door, isn't that what the SS staff used to boast about here? They could turn a Jew into smoke in 45 minutes. 12,000 Jews a day. 800,000 in all.
Radek emitted a mirthless chuckle, an interrogator who did not believe the statement of his prisoner. Gabriel felt as though a stone had been laid over his heart.
800,000? Where did you get a number like that?
That's the official estimate from the Polish government.
And do you expect a bunch of subhumans like the Poles to be able to know what happened here in these woods?
His voice seemed suddenly different, more youthful and commanding.
Please, Alon, if we are going to have this discussion, let us deal with facts and not Polish idiocy. 800,000?
He shook his head and actually smiled.
No, it wasn't 800,000. The actual number was much higher than that.
A gust of sudden wind stirred the treetops. To Gabriel it sounded like the rushing of white water. Radek held out his hand and asked for the flashlight. Gabriel hesitated.
You don't think I'm going to attack you, Visit, do you?
I know some of the things you've done. That was a long time ago.
Gabriel handed him the flashlight. Radek pointed the beam to the left, illuminating a stand of evergreens.
They called this area the lower camp. The SS quarters were right over there. The perimeter fence ran behind them. In front there was a paved road with shrubbery and flowers in spring and summer. You might find this hard to believe, but it was really very pleasant. There weren't so many trees, of course. We planted the trees after raising the camp. They were just saplings then. Now they are fully mature. Quite beautiful. Usually around 40. Jewish girls cleaned for them, but they had Poles to do the cooking. 3 local girls who came from the surrounding villages.
And the Ukrainians?
They were quartered on the opposite side of the road in 5 barracks. Stangl's house was in between at the intersection of 2 roads. He had a lovely garden. It was designed for him by a man from Vienna.
But the arrivals never saw that part of the camp?
No, no. Each part of the camp was carefully concealed from the other by fences interlaced with pine branches. When they arrived at the camp, they saw what appeared to be an ordinary country rail station, complete with a false timetable for departing trains. There were no departures from Treblinka, of course. Only empty trains left this platform.
There was a building here, was there not?
It was made up to look like an ordinary station house, but in fact it was filled with valuables that had been taken from previous arrivals. That section over there they referred to as Station Square. Over there was Reception Square or the Sorting Square.
Did you ever see the transports arrive?
I had nothing to do with that sort of business, but yes, I saw them arrive.
There were 2 different arrival procedures, one for Jews from Western Europe and another for Jews from the East?
Yes, that's correct. Western European Jews were treated with great deception and fakery. There were no whips, no shouting.
They were asked politely to disembark the train. Medical personnel in white uniforms were waiting in reception square to care for the infirm. It was all a ruse, though. The old and the sick were taken off immediately and shot. He nodded. And the Eastern Jews? How were they greeted at the platform? They were met by Ukrainian whips. And then? Radek raised the flashlight and followed the beam a short distance across the clearing. There was a barbed wire enclosure here. Behind the wire were two buildings. One was the disrobing barracks. In the second building, work Jews cut the hair off the women. When they were finished, they went that way. Radek used the flashlight to illuminate the path. There was a passage here, rather like a cattle chute, a few feet wide, barbed wire and pine branches. It was called the Tube. But the SS had a special name for it, didn't they? Radek nodded. They called it the Road to Heaven. And where did the Road to Heaven lead? Radek raised the beam of his light. The upper camp, he said. The death camp. They walked forward into a large clearing strewn with hundreds of boulders, each stone representing a Jewish community destroyed at Treblinka. The largest stone bore the name Warsaw. Gabriel looked beyond the stones toward the sky in the east. It was beginning to grow faintly lighter. The road to heaven led directly into a brick building housing the gas chambers, Radek said, breaking the silence. He seemed suddenly eager to talk. Each chamber was 4 meters by 4 meters. Initially there were only 3, but they soon discovered that they needed more capacity to keep up with demand. 10 more were added. A diesel engine pumped carbon monoxide fumes into the chambers. Asphyxiation resulted in less than 30 minutes. After that, the bodies were removed. What was done to them? For several months, they were buried out there in large pits. But very quickly the pits overflowed, and the decomposition of the bodies contaminated the camp. Which is when you arrived? Not immediately. Treblinka was the 4th camp on our list. We cleaned the pits at Birkenau first, then Belzec and Sobibor. We didn't get to Treblinka until March of 1943. When I arrived, his voice trailed off. Terrible. What did you do? We opened the pits, of course, and removed the bodies. By hand? He shook his head. We had a mechanical shovel. It made the work go much faster. The claw. Isn't that what you called it? Yes, that's right. And after the bodies were removed, they were incinerated on large iron racks. You had a special name for the racks, did you not? Roasts, Radek said. We called them roasts. And after the bodies were burnt, we crushed the bones and reburied them in the pits, or carted them off to the Bug and dumped them in the river. And when the old pits were all emptied? After that, the bodies were taken straight from the gas chambers to the roasts. It worked that way until October of that year, when the camp was shut down, and all traces of it were obliterated. It operated for a little more than a year. And yet they still managed to murder 800,000. Not 800,000. How many, then? More than 1 million. That's quite a thing, isn't it? More than 1 million people in a tiny place like this, in the middle of a Polish forest. Gabriel took back the flashlight and drew his Beretta. He prodded Radek forward. They walked along a footpath through the field of stones. Zalman and Navot remained behind in the upper camp. Gabriel could hear the sound of Oded's footsteps in the gravel behind him. Congratulations, Radek. Because of you, it's only a symbolic cemetery. Are you going to kill me now? Have I not told you what you wanted to hear? Gabriel pushed him along the path. You may take a certain pride in this place, but for us it is sacred ground. Do you really think I would pollute it with your blood? Then what is the point of this? Why did you bring me here? You needed to see it one more time. You needed to visit the scene of the crime to refresh your memory and prepare for your upcoming testimony.
That's how you're going to save your son the humiliation of having a man like you as a father. You're going to come back to Israel and pay for your crimes.
It wasn't my crime. I didn't kill them. I just did what Müller ordered me to do. I cleaned up the mess.
You did your fair share of killing, Radek. Remember your little game with Max Klein in Birkenau? And what about the death march? You were there too, weren't you, Radek?
Radek slowed and turned his head. Gabriel gave him a push between the shoulder blades. They came to a large rectangular depression where the cremation pit had been. It was filled now with pieces of black basalt.
Kill me now, damn it. Don't take me to Israel. Just do it now and get it over with. Besides, that's what you're good at, isn't it, Alon?
Not here, Gabriel said. Not in this place. You don't deserve to even set foot here, let alone die here.
Radek fell to his knees before the pit.
And if I agree to come with you, what fate awaits me?
The truth awaits you, Radek. You'll stand before the Israeli people and confess your crimes. Your role in Axion 1005, the murders of prisoners at Birkenau, the killings you carried out during the death march from Birkenau. Do you even remember the girls you murdered, Radek?
Radek's head twisted round.
How do you...
Gabriel cut him off. You won't face trial for your crimes, but you'll spend the rest of your life behind bars. While you're in prison, you'll work with a team of Holocaust scholars from Yad Vashem to compile a thorough history of Action 1005. You'll tell the deniers and the doubters exactly what you did to conceal the greatest case of mass murder in history. You'll tell the truth for the first time in your life.
Whose truth? Yours or mine?
There's only one truth, Radek. Treblinka is the truth.
And what do I get in return?
More than you deserve, Gabriel said. We'll say nothing about Metzler's dubious parentage.
You're willing to stomach an Austrian chancellor of the far right in order to get to me?
Something tells me Peter Metzler is going to become a great friend of Israel and Jews. He'll want to do nothing to anger us. After all, we'll hold the keys to his destruction long after you're dead.
How did you convince the Americans to betray me? Blackmail, I suppose. That's the Jewish way. But there must have been more. Surely you vowed that you would never give me an opportunity to discuss my affiliation with Organization Galen or the CIA. I suppose your dedication to the truth goes only so far.
Give me your answer, Radek.
How can I trust you, a Jew, to live up to your end of the bargain?
Have you been reading Der Stürmer again? You'll trust me, because you have no other choice.
And what good will it do? Will it bring back even one person who died in this place?
No, Gabriel conceded. But the world will know the truth, and you'll spend the last years of your life where you belong. Take the deal, Radek. Take it for your son. Think of it as one last escape.
It won't stay secret forever. Someday the truth of this affair will come out.
Eventually, Gabriel said. I suppose you can't hide the truth forever.
Radek's head pivoted slowly around, and he stared at Gabriel contemptuously.
If you were a real man, you'd do it yourself.
He managed a mocking smile.
As for the truth, no one cared while this place was in operation, and no one will care now.
He turned and looked into the pit. Gabriel pocketed the Beretta and walked away. Oded, Zalman, and Navot stood motionless on the footpath behind him. Gabriel brushed past them without a word, and headed down through the camp to the rail platform. Before turning into the trees, he paused briefly to look over his shoulder, and saw Radek, clinging to the arm of Oded, rising slowly to his feet. Part 4. The Prisoner of Abu Kabir. Chapter 39. Jaffa, Israel. There was considerable debate over where to put him. Lev thought him a security risk and wanted him kept permanently under office care. Shamron, as usual, took the opposite position, if for no other reason than he did not want his beloved service in the business of running jails. The Prime Minister, only half-jokingly, suggested that Radek be force-marched into the Negev to be picked over by the scorpions and the vultures. It was Gabriel, eventually, who carried the day. The worst punishment for a man like Radek, Gabriel argued, was to be treated like a common criminal. They searched for a suitable place to lock him away and settled on a police detention facility, originally built by the British during the Mandate, in a seedy quarter of Jaffa still known by its Arab name, Abu Kabir. A period of 72 hours passed before Radek's capture was made public. The Prime Minister's communique was terse and deliberately misleading. Great care was taken to avoid needlessly embarrassing the Austrians. Radek, the Prime Minister said, was discovered living under a false identity in an unspecified country. After a period of negotiation, he had consented to come to Israel voluntarily. Under the terms of the agreement, he would not face trial, since under Israeli law the only possible sentence was death. Instead, he would remain under permanent administrative detention and would effectively plead guilty to his crimes against humanity by working with a team of historians at Yad Vashem and Hebrew University to produce a definitive history of Action 1005. There was little fanfare and none of the excitement that accompanied news of Eichmann's kidnapping. Indeed, word of Radek's capture was overshadowed within hours by a suicide bomber who murdered 25 people in a Jerusalem market. Lev derived a certain crude satisfaction from the development, for it seemed to prove his point that the state had more important things to worry about than chasing down old Nazis. He began referring to the affair as Shamron's folly, though he quickly found himself out of step with the rank and file of his own service. Within King Saul Boulevard, Radek's capture seemed to rekindle old fires. Lev adjusted his stance to meet the prevailing mood, but it was too late. Everyone knew that Radek's apprehension had been engineered by the Memune and Gabriel, and that Lev had tried to block it at every turn. Lev's standing among the foot soldiers fell to dangerously low levels. The half-hearted attempt to keep secret Radek's Austrian identity was undone by the videotape of his arrival at Abu Kabir. The Vienna press quickly and correctly identified the prisoner as Ludwig Vogel, an Austrian businessman of some note. Did he truly agree to leave Vienna voluntarily? Or was he in fact kidnapped from his fortress-like home in the First District? In the days that followed, the newspapers were filled with speculative accounts of Vogel's mystifying career and political connections. The press investigations strayed perilously close to Peter Metzler. Renata Hoffmann of the Coalition for a Better Austria called for an official inquiry into the affair and suggested that Radek may have been linked to the bombing of wartime claims and inquiries and the mysterious death of an elderly Jew named Max Klein. Her demands fell largely on deaf ears. The bombing was the work of Islamic terrorists, the government said, and as for the unfortunate death of Max Klein, it was a suicide. Further investigation, said the Minister of Justice, was pointless. The next chapter in the Radek affair would take place not in Vienna but in Paris, where a mossy, former KGB man popped up on French television to suggest Radek was Moscow's man in Vienna. A former Stasi spymaster, who'd become something of a literary sensation in the New Germany, laid claim to Radek as well. Shamron first suspected the claims were part of a coordinated campaign of disinformation designed to inoculate the CIA from the Radek virus, which is exactly how he would have played it had he been in their shoes. Then he learned that inside the agency, the suggestions that Radek may have been plying his trade on both sides of the street had caused something of a panic. Files were being hauled out of the deep freeze. A team of elderly Soviet hands was being hastily assembled. Shamron secretly reveled in the anxiety of his colleagues from Langley. Were it to turn out that Radek was a double agent, Shamron said, it would be profoundly just. Adrian Carter requested permission to put Radek under the lights when the Israeli historians were finished with him. Shamron promised to give the matter thorough consideration. The prisoner of Abu Kabir was largely oblivious to the storm swirling around him. His confinement was solitary, though not unduly harsh. He kept his cell and his clothing neat. He took food and complained little. His guards, though they longed to hate him,
could not. He was a policeman at his core, and his jailers seemed to see something in him they recognized. He treated them courteously and was treated courteously in return. He was something of a curiosity. They had read about men like him at school, and they wandered past his cell at all hours just to have a look. Radek began to feel increasingly as though he were an exhibit in a museum. He made only one request, that he be granted a newspaper each day so he could keep abreast of current affairs. The question was taken all the way to Shamron, who gave his consent, so long as it was an Israeli newspaper and not some German publication. Each morning a Jerusalem Post arrived with his breakfast tray. He usually skipped the stories about himself, they were largely inaccurate in any case, and turned straight to the foreign news section to read about developments in the Austrian election. Moshe Rivlin paid Radek several visits to prepare for his upcoming testimony. It was decided that the sessions would be videotaped and broadcast nightly on Israeli television. Radek seemed to grow more agitated as the day of his first public appearance drew nearer. Rivlin quietly asked the chief of the detention facility to keep the prisoner under a suicide watch. A guard was posted in the corridor, just beyond the bars of Radek's cell. Radek chafed under the added surveillance at first, but was soon glad for the company. On the day before Radek's testimony, Rivlin came one final time. They spent an hour together. Radek was preoccupied and, for the first time, largely uncooperative. Rivlin packed away his documents and notes and asked the guard to open the cell door.
"I want to see him," Radek said suddenly. "Ask him whether he would do me the honor of paying me a visit. Tell him I have a few questions I'd like to ask him."
"I can't make any promises," Rivlin said. "I'm not connected to..."
"Just ask him,"
Radek said.
"The worst he can do is say no."
Shamron imposed on Gabriel to remain in Israel until the opening day of Radek's testimony, and Gabriel, though he was anxious to return to Venice, reluctantly agreed. He stayed in the safe flat near the Zion Gate, and woke each morning to the sound of church bells in the Armenian quarter. He would sit on the shadowed terrace overlooking the walls of the old city, and linger over coffee and the newspapers. He followed the Radek affair closely. He was pleased that Shamron's name was linked to the capture and not his. Gabriel lived abroad, under an assumed identity, and he did not need his real name splashed about in the press. Besides, after all Shamron had done for his country, he deserved one final day in the sun. As the days eased slowly past, Gabriel found that Radek seemed more and more a stranger to him. Though blessed with a near photographic memory, Gabriel struggled to clearly recall Radek's face or the sound of his voice. Treblinka seemed something from a nightmare. He wondered whether it had been this way for his mother. Did Radek remain in the rooms of her memory like an uninvited guest, or did she force herself to recall him in order to render his image on canvas? Had it been like this for all those who had encountered so perfect an evil? Perhaps it explained the silence that descended on those who had survived. Perhaps they had been mercifully released from the pain of their memories as a means of self-preservation. One idea turned ceaselessly in his thoughts. If Radek had murdered his mother that day in Poland instead of two other girls, he would never have existed. He, too, began to feel the guilt of survival. He was certain of only one thing. He was not ready to forget. And so he was pleased when one of Lev's acolytes telephoned one afternoon and wondered whether he would be willing to write an official history of the affair. Gabriel accepted, on the condition that he also produce a sanitized version of the events to be kept in the archives at Yad Vashem. There was a good deal of back and forth about when such a document could be made public. A release date of 40 years hence was set, and Gabriel went to work. He wrote at the kitchen table, on a notebook computer supplied by the office. Each evening, he locked the computer in a floor safe concealed beneath the living room couch. He had no experience writing, so instinctively he approached the project as though it were a painting. He started with an underdrawing, broad and amorphous, then slowly added layers of paint. He used a simple palette, and his brush technique was careful. As the days wore on, Radek's face returned to him, as clearly as it had been rendered by the hand of his mother. He would work until the early afternoon, then take a break and walk over to the Hadassah University Hospital, where, after a month of unconsciousness, Eli Levon was showing signs that he might be emerging from his coma. Gabriel would sit with Levon for an hour or so and talk to him about the case. Then he would return to the flat and work until dark. On the day he completed the report, he lingered at the hospital until early evening, and happened to be there when Levon's eyes opened. Levon stared blankly into space for a moment. Then the old inquisitiveness returned to his gaze, and it flickered around the unfamiliar surroundings of the hospital room, before finally settling on Gabriel's face.
"Where are we? Vienna?"
"Jerusalem."
"What are you doing here?"
"I'm working on a report for the office."
"About what?"
"The capture of a Nazi war criminal named Erich Radek."
"Radek?"
"He was living in Vienna under the name Ludwig Vogel." Levon smiled.
"Tell me everything," he murmured.
But before Gabriel could say another word, he was gone again. When Gabriel returned to the flat that evening, the light was winking on the answering machine. He pressed the play button and heard the voice of Moshe Rivlin. "The prisoner of Abu Kabir would like a word. I'd tell him to go to hell. It's your call." Chapter 40. Jaffa, Israel. The detention center was surrounded by a high wall the color of sandstone, topped by coils of razor wire. Gabriel presented himself at the outer entrance early the following morning and was admitted without delay. To reach the interior, he had to travel a narrow, fenced passage that reminded him too much of the road to heaven at Treblinka. A warder awaited him at the other end. He led Gabriel silently into the secure lockup, then into a windowless interrogation room with bare cinder block walls. Radek was seated statue-like at the table, dressed for his testimony in a dark suit and tie. His hands were cuffed and folded on the table. He acknowledged Gabriel with an almost imperceptible nod of his head, but remained seated.
"Remove the handcuffs," Gabriel said to the warder. "It's against policy."
Gabriel glared at the warder, and a moment later the cuffs were gone.
"You do that very well," Radek said. "Was that another psychological ploy on your part? Are you trying to demonstrate your dominion over me?"
Gabriel pulled out the crude iron chair and sat down.
"I wouldn't think that under these conditions a demonstration like that would be necessary." "I suppose you're right," Radek said. "Still, I do admire the way you handle the entire affair. I would like to think I would have done as well."
"For whom?" Gabriel asked. "The Americans or the Russians?"
"You're referring to the allegations made in Paris by that idiot, Belov? Are they true?"
Radek regarded Gabriel in silence, and for just a few seconds some of the old steel returned to his blue eyes.
"When one plays the game as long as I did, one makes so many alliances and engages in so much deception that in the end it's sometimes difficult to know where the truth and the lies part company."
"Belov seems certain he knows the truth."
"Yes, but I'm afraid it's the certainty of a fool. You see, Belov was in no position to know the truth."
Radek changed the subject.
"I assume you've seen the papers this morning?"
Gabriel nodded.
"His margin of victory was larger than expected.
Apparently,
my arrest had something to do with it. Austrians have never liked outsiders meddling in their affairs."
"You're not gloating, are you?"
"Of course not," Radek said. "I'm only sorry I didn't drive a harder bargain at Treblinka. Perhaps I shouldn't have agreed so easily. I'm not so certain Peter's campaign would have been derailed by the revelations about my past."
"There are some things that are politically unpalatable, even in a country like Austria."
"You underestimate us, Alon."
Gabriel permitted a silence to fall between them. He was already beginning to regret his decision to come.
Moshe Rivlin said you wanted to see me, he said dismissively. I don't have much time.
Radek sat a little straighter in his chair.
I was wondering whether you might do me the professional courtesy of answering a couple of questions.
That depends on the questions. You and I are in different professions, Radek.
Yes, Radek said. I was an agent of American intelligence, and you are an assassin.
Gabriel stood to leave. Radek put up a hand.
Wait, he said. Sit down, please.
Gabriel returned to his seat.
The man who telephoned my house the night of the kidnapping.
You mean your arrest? Radek dipped his head.
All right, my arrest. I assume he was an imposter.
Gabriel nodded.
He was very good. How did he manage to impersonate Cruz so well?
You don't expect me to answer that, do you, Radek?
Gabriel looked at his watch. I hope you didn't bring me all the way to Jaffa to ask me one question.
No, Radek said. There is one other thing I'd like to know. When we were at Treblinka, you mentioned that I had taken part in the evacuation of prisoners from Birkenau. Gabriel interrupted him. Can we please, at long last, drop the euphemisms, Radek? It wasn't an evacuation. It was a death march. Radek was silent for a moment.
You also mentioned that I personally killed some of the prisoners.
I know you murdered at least two girls, Gabriel said.
I'm sure there were more.
Radek closed his eyes and nodded slowly.
There were more, he said distantly. Many more.
I remember that day, as though it were last week.
I had known the end was coming for some time, but seeing that line of prisoners marching toward the Reich, I knew then that it was Götterdämmerung. It was truly the twilight of the gods.
And so you started killing them? He nodded again.
They had entrusted me with the task of protecting their terrible secret, and then they let several thousand witnesses walk out of Birkenau alive. I'm sure you can imagine how I felt.
No, Gabriel said truthfully. I can't begin to imagine how you felt.
There was a girl, Radek said. I remember asking her what she would say to her children about the war. She answered that she would tell them the truth. I ordered her to lie. She refused. I killed two other girls, and still she defied me. For some reason, I let her walk away. I stopped killing the prisoners after that. I knew after looking into her eyes that it was pointless.
Gabriel looked down at his hands, refusing to rise to Radek's bait.
I assume this woman was your witness? Radek asked.
Yes, she was.
It's funny, Radek said, but she has your eyes.
Gabriel looked up. He hesitated, then said, so they tell me.
She's your mother.
Another hesitation, then the truth.
I would tell you that I'm sorry, Radek said, but I know my apology would mean nothing to you.
You're right, Gabriel said. Don't say it.
So it was for her that you did this?
No, said Gabriel. It was for all of them. The door opened. The warder stepped into the room and announced that it was time to leave for Yad Vashem. Radek rose slowly to his feet and held out his hands. His eyes remained fastened to Gabriel's face as the cuffs were ratcheted around his wrists. Gabriel accompanied him as far as the entrance, then watched him make his way through the fenced-in passage into the back of a waiting van. He had seen enough. Now he wanted only to forget. After leaving Abu Kabir, Gabriel drove up to Safed to see Tsiona. They ate lunch in a small kebab cafe in the artist's quarter. She tried to engage him in conversation about the Radek affair, but Gabriel, only 2 hours removed from the murderer's presence, was in no mood to discuss him further. He swore Tsiona to secrecy about his involvement in the case, then hastily changed the subject. They spoke of art for a time, then politics, and finally the state of Gabriel's life. Tsiona knew of an empty flat a few streets over from her own. It was large enough to house a studio and was blessed with some of the most gorgeous light in the Upper Galilee. Gabriel promised he would think about it, but Tsiona knew that he was merely placating her. The restlessness had returned to his eyes. He was ready to leave. Over coffee, he told her that he had found a place for some of his mother's work.
Where?
The Museum of Holocaust Art at Yad Vashem. Tsiona's eyes welled over with tears.
How perfect, she said.
After lunch, they climbed the cobblestone stairs to Tsiona's apartment. She unlocked the storage closet and carefully removed the paintings. They spent an hour selecting 20 of the best pieces for Yad Vashem. Tsiona had discovered 2 more canvases bearing the image of Erich Radek. She asked Gabriel what he wanted her to do with them.
Burn them, he replied.
But they're probably worth a great deal of money now.
I don't care what they're worth, Gabriel said. I never want to see his face again.
Tsiona helped him load the paintings into his car. He set out for Jerusalem beneath a sky heavy with cloud. He went first to Yad Vashem. A curator took possession of the paintings, then hurried back inside to watch the beginning of Erich Radek's testimony. So it seemed did the rest of the country. Gabriel drove through silent streets to the Mount of Olives. He laid a stone on his mother's grave and recited the words of the mourner's Kaddish for her. He did the same at the grave of his father. Then he drove to the airport and caught the evening flight for Rome. Chapter 41. Venice, Vienna. The following morning, in the sestiere of Canareggio, Francesco Tiepolo entered the church of San Giovanni Crisostomo and made his way slowly across the nave. He peered into the chapel of St. Jerome and saw lights burning behind the shrouded work platform. He crept forward, seized the scaffolding in his bear-like paw, and shook it once violently. The restorer raised his magnifying visor and peered down at him like a gargoyle.
"Welcome home, Mario," Tiepolo called up. "I was beginning to worry about you. Where have you been?"
The restorer lowered his visor and turned his gaze once more to the Bellini.
"I've been gathering sparks, Francesco."
Gathering sparks? Tiepolo knew better than to ask. He only cared that the restorer was finally back in Venice.
How long before you finish?
3 months, said the restorer. Maybe 4.
3 would be better.
Yes, Francesco, I know 3 months would be better, but if you keep shaking my platform, I'll never finish.
You're not planning on running any more errands, are you, Mario?
Just one, he said, his brush poised before the canvas. But it won't take long, I promise.
That's what you always say.
The package arrived at the clock shop in Vienna's first district via motorcycle courier exactly 3 weeks later. The clockmaker took delivery personally. He affixed his signature to the courier's clipboard and gave him a small gratuity for his trouble. Then he carried the parcel into his workshop and placed it on the table. The courier climbed back on the motorbike and sped away, slowing briefly at the end of the street, just long enough to signal the woman seated behind the wheel of a Renault sedan. The woman punched in a number on her cell phone and pressed the send button. A moment later, the clockmaker answered.
"I just sent you a clock," she said. "Did you receive it?"
"Who is this?"
"I'm a friend of Max Klein," she whispered, "and Eli Levon, and Rebecca Gazit, and Sarah Greenberg."
She lowered the phone and pressed 4 numbers in quick succession, then turned her head in time to see the bright red ball of fire erupt from the front of the clockmaker's shop. She eased away from the curb, her hand trembling on the wheel, and headed toward the Ringstrasse. Gabriel had abandoned his motorcycle and was waiting on the corner. She stopped long enough for him to climb in, then turned onto the broad boulevard and vanished into the evening traffic. A Staats Polizei car sped past in the opposite direction. Chiara kept her eyes on the road.
"Are you all right?"
"I think I'm going to be sick."
"Yes, I know. Do you want me to drive?"
"No, I can do it."
"You should have let me send the detonation signal. I didn't want you to feel responsible for another death in Vienna."
She punched a tear from her cheek. "Did you think of them when you heard the explosion? Did you think of Leah and Dani?"
He hesitated, then shook his head.
"What did you think of?"
He reached out and brushed away another tear.
"You, Chiara," he said softly. "I thought only of you."
This is John Lee. We hope you've enjoyed this production of A Death in Vienna by Daniel Silver. To find out more about the complete Books on Tape catalog of unabridged audiobooks, call our customer service department at the number on this package, or visit us online at booksontape.com. A Death in Vienna, copyright 2004 by Daniel Silver. Published by arrangement with Random House Audio Publishing Group, a division of Random House Incorporated. Production copyright 2004, Books on Tape.